Michael's going to read from our passage, which you can see on the screen. It's Mark chapter 5. And just a reminder, we're in this kind of section of really serious miracles of Jesus, the big four, you could call them, calming of the storm, casting out of legion, and now the healing of the woman and Jairus' daughter. This is another of Mark's split screen accounts, two events woven together. So this is a two-parter this week and next week. Today we're going to focus just on verses 21 through to 34.
And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her, so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease."
About 100 years ago, Sir Ernest Shackleton headed off to Antarctica, led an expedition there. And there's an oft-quoted story about how he got his kind of team together, receiving applications which he whittled down, 5,000 applications, he whittled them down by sifting them into three piles: mad, hopeless, and possible. And the cases in our passages this week and next fit firmly in the hopeless tray. And it's into this hopelessness that we see Jesus most clearly. I think it's the really wonderful thing about chapter 5. Just a reminder of where we've been going. We've had that question at the end of chapter 4, as the disciples saw Jesus in complete control of even the wind and the waves, and asked the logical question, well, who then is this? That question really stands at the heading of chapter 5. Every time we see one of these miracles of Jesus, we should be thinking of that question and thinking, what is our answer to it? Who then is Jesus? Who is the man who was able to cast out an army of demons who have had complete control over one man? Who is this? And so what we're seeing in these big four miracles, Jesus saves from, I'm quoting from someone here, the worst violence of nature, the worst powers of the devils last week. This week, Jesus saves from disease no man could cure. Then next week, Jesus saves from death itself. It seems to be ramping up to even death. But it's not just a display of power. It's a very tender account here about how Jesus wants to take our very small faith and grow it into something really personable and real, and Jesus-focused. The first person we see here is desperate in the face of impending death. So this is Jairus in verse 21 to 24. And first of all, we're told, just before he arrives on the scene, that they've gone back to the other side of the lake. It can be useful sometimes to work out well, what does that mean? Maybe this map helps you, maybe not. Right is the kind of big picture of Israel with the Sea of Galilee near the top. And on the left there, you can see where we've been over these weeks. So number one is the storm, middle of the lake, that first big miracle. Then they were headed to the other side of the lake, to the non-Jewish side, where there was that encounter with the man with all the demons. Now they've headed back, hence they came to the other side. Sorry, I'm going to quote the right bit. They've crossed again in the boat to the other side. So they've crossed back to the Jewish side, which we assume is Capernaum, which is where Jesus has had his base. It's not no longer Nazareth, but Capernaum. That fits with the tabernacle and Jairus and so on. And so it's here that these events are going on. They're all linked around this geography of the lake. And it's here that we see this desperate man. Jairus comes forward, one of the rulers of the synagogue, not the ruler, but nevertheless a prominent person in the town. I doubt many people had seen him in such a state ever before. His little daughter is at the point of death. The language is literally at the final extremity of life. The light of his life is about to go out. He might be the town leader, but that doesn't stop him sharing the same desperation as the woman in the passage. Because money can buy healthcare, can't it? But it can't buy health. The daughter of Ringo Starr, the drummer from the Beatles, she was seriously ill for years. And as Ringo put it, it doesn't matter if you're the king, you're a Beatle, or you're a bin man. You've got to deal with stuff. Now, I hope none of us experience what Jairus is feeling, but many will know the helplessness we feel when a loved one is seriously ill and out of our own ability to help. Heading into surgery, perhaps. There's no strings you can pull. There's no levers. You've done all you can. You're helpless. You're in the hands of others. I heard yesterday of a jellyfish whose sting can bring an overwhelming sense of foreboding. Jairus doesn't need that jellyfish to feel that. He's got it in spades. This Jairus comes. Verse 22, he falls at Jesus' feet and implores him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter, she's at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." Don't you warm to him? He's not too proud to beg for the life of his little one. And wonderfully, we read in verse 24 that Jesus went with him. There's always hope. There's always a bit of hope so long as she is still alive and Jesus is coming. And as they made their way towards Jairus' home, we're told that a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And this is where Mark's split screen takes us to someone else who's part of that crowd. She's there for a particular purpose that only she knows. Whereas Jairus was desperate in the face of impending death, this woman is desperate in the face of incurable disease. It's likely that her condition means she's suffering from some sort of menstrual complaint. And for 12 years, she had suffered with this. The word suffered is only used in Mark elsewhere for Jesus' own suffering, as he describes it in chapter 8 and 9. Note what the medical profession has and has not been able to do for her. It couldn't give her her health, but it did a great job of taking her money. In the space of one verse, verse 26, we've got a summary of her hospital notes, as it were. But if you'd seen her life, if you'd followed her around, you would have seen all the multiple bus rides and trips on the Capernaum Underground, to see multiple consultants receiving numerous opinions, prescriptions again, hopes raised, hopes dashed, just going around in circles, and at this point finding she was no better, but actually worse than ever before, as well as not having two shekels to rub together. There's a kind of a little impression that maybe the doctors may have contributed to the fact that she's worse than she was. Reminds me of that strange fact that it's not actually completely isolated, but when doctors in Brazil went on strike in 1973, the number of daily deaths fell by a third. Some weird stuff going on there. You can look it up. There are reasons why these things happen. Modern medicine is at its best when it continues to strive to advance whilst retaining a great humility as well, knowing that it is not God. But this is not an anti-medical point. One of the gospel writers, of course, was a doctor. I think it's broader than that. The world doesn't have the answers. So, she's a very different person in many respects to Jairus. He's a prominent man. She's an unclean woman because, as well as the sickness, she had other suffering. Socially and religiously, there was an isolation. In Leviticus 15 in the Old Testament, there's a section entitled, in our Bibles, Laws About Bodily Discharges. Some light reading for you. And it explains that in the Law of Moses, all bodily discharges made a person ritually unclean for a short time. And everyone functioned in multiple ways on the basis of that. It taught something theologically. We're not thinking about that now. But her condition meant that she was a permanent version of it. She was constantly, therefore, unclean. So whoever and whatever she came into contact with would also become unclean, which I think explains something of her fear down in verse 33 when she's pulled out from the crowd. So she's probably lacking a lot of confidence in a lot of places, including the doctors she's seen, but she does have confidence in one place. Verse 27 tells us that she's heard of Jesus. If I could just touch him, I'll be made well. Not even touch him, actually, but touch his clothes, his garments. She's not named, but let's call her Caroline, reaching out, touching me, touching you. Sorry. Now, you might think, is this a weird thing to think? Calling her Caroline, that's a weird thing to think. But is it a weird thing to think that touching Jesus would make you well? Well, actually, in the next chapter, right at the end of chapter 6, there's a verse that says that people were coming and touching even the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well. So this was happening. There's a strange tradition in England. I don't know if it's in other parts of the world as well. We have some very strange things in England, so American friends and others, do forgive us. There was this thing called the royal touch. Queen Anne brought it back in, apparently, in the early 18th century. And she once touched Dr. Samuel Johnson before he was a doctor, when he was a baby, because he had scrofula. And she gave him the royal touch. And it was believed you could be cured by the royal touch. Can I have a guess whether it worked or not? No. He went on to have an operation. But based on her confidence, this woman, Caroline, reaches out, and we read, verse 29, immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Hudson Taylor talked of three stages of God's work. First, it is impossible. Then it is difficult. Then it is done. Notice it happens without any apparent intention of Jesus. So we notice with the healing of the leper, he said, I am willing, be healed. We notice the will of Christ is enough to heal without even doing anything else. If you notice Premier League footballers, they like to do this thing where they do a no-look pass. You've seen that? it's just a bit of a thing this year, I think, where they'll do this fancy thing without seemingly watching, and it can be really effective when it comes off. But it's almost like a no-look healing. Jesus just does it. The doctors for 12 years have been struggling, comparing notes, looking at x-rays. They haven't done it. Jesus just does this healing. He hasn't even thought about it. She knows, verse 29, but she mustn't react. She doesn't want to come out in the open. She wants to edge away and get away. But Jesus has another idea. I think it's a really interesting question to ask. Why doesn't Jesus leave it here at this point? Why does he need to bring her out in the open? Some people think, well, maybe it teaches that we should testify publicly about what Christ has done, shouldn't keep it to ourselves, and maybe there's truth in that. I'm not sure that's completely it, though. But let's think about that. Just as she was immediately healed, so Jesus immediately turns around to the crowd and says, "Who touched my clothes?" And they all go, "Everyone? How's about that? Everyone?" It's interesting. It implies that when Jesus healed, it was never a sort of uncostly, thoughtless healing. Something, some loss, or something went out from him. Jesus insists on stopping and looking around to see who had done it. He won't let it drop. So the action that the woman desperately wanted to be secret is now in danger of becoming very public, so public that we're still reading about it today. Jesus flushes her out, you could say, to her embarrassment, yes, I think. Certainly her fear and trembling, as we're told in verse 33, as she fell down before him and then told him the whole truth. Probably that included, actually, Jesus, I'm not meant to be here. I'm unclean. Everyone I touch is, and therefore I'm so sorry that I've even touched the rabbi. But as with the earlier leper, her uncleanness doesn't infect Jesus. The power flows the other way. And Jesus' words to her, I just encourage you to look at them. They're just a wonderful, just droplets of grace to her. Gentle reassurance. "Daughter," he says. It's the only time it's ever used like this in the Gospels. "Daughter," in a figurative way. "Your faith has made you well." In other words, it wasn't just the touch. This isn't magic. It's your simple childlike trust in me that I see and value. She gets to hear about the importance of faith from him. "Go in peace," an Old Testament phrase of divine blessing. Having come to Jesus in fear, she's going to go away in peace. "Go in peace and be healed of your disease." Jairus is probably thinking, hopping from one foot to the other, "This is all very lovely, but I bet he was tempted to throttle her." Don't you think? Nothing personal, of course, but is she not aware, like everyone else is, where they're going? That there was a dying child to get to, an extreme emergency that couldn't wait. How selfish could she be? But of course, any complaint shouldn't go to her. It must actually go to Jesus. He's the one that's insisting on this encounter. You know, it's a trivial example, but one we can probably relate to. Your call is important to us. You are currently 13 in the queue. Your stress levels depend on how much time you've got and how important the thing is. Jairus had got to number one in the Jesus queue, a position he needed to keep more than anything he had ever needed before. And now his place is being taken by an unnecessary discussion with a woman who has coped for 12 years with something. Surely she can cope for another 12 minutes. I did wonder about entitling this sermon, "That Bleeding Woman," a sentiment that Jairus might have privately agreed with at this point, but it didn't feel appropriate. So Jairus learned so much that day, and next week we'll have a chance to focus on him and what Jesus was teaching him. This week our focus is on the woman. We're thinking this morning of Jesus' ability to save from disease no man could cure. We mustn't miss that big, obvious point in this miracle. What she seeks is met instantly in Christ. What sin and death deal out, he removes. But that truth is presented to us in a particular way. Why did Jesus require this face-to-face meeting, which had Jairus just going crazy? You know, thinking about that question, what do we gain from these encounters being back-to-back? The fact that Jairus is there in the background while this woman is being dealt with. It's not necessarily obvious why Mark has put these together, but typically he does want us to compare. So there are examples like in chapter 11, there's another split screen where you have the fig tree and then the temple, then back to the fruitless fig tree, and the point is quite clear. The temple, all the rituals of Judaism, is fruitless and under judgment. Well, what's going on here? Why? There's clearly a lesson. Well, I think there's a lesson about who Jesus has come for. The fact that people like Jairus and people like this woman all need Jesus, all share the same sinfulness and fallenness and the same desperation, no matter how prominent you are in society or how low you are in society. Actually, before Christ, you're the same. I think there is a point that comes out in comparing Jairus and the woman. There is a lesson about faith. Jairus is called to have faith. I think we're going to see next week. He's called to have a faith like hers. He's meant to look at her example. We'll see that next week. But perhaps another lesson, building on this split screen idea. What does it add that they're together? There's a common phrase in Jesus' encounter with the woman and with Jairus. Have you noticed what it is? Daughter. So Jairus' little daughter is sick. Jesus calls the woman in verse 34, daughter. Now, Jairus' concern for his daughter is obvious to us, isn't it? You know, it's heart-wrenching. We don't have to be convinced that that's a real concern. We can understand it. But you know what? Very few of us would see the woman like that. And in that society, people would not have seen the woman in that same way. Their hearts would not have gone out to her in the same way. To those who knew her condition, she was one to keep at a distance. And at this particular moment, nobody wanted this encounter. The woman herself didn't. Jairus certainly didn't. It seems the disciples were on Jairus' side as well. Come on, let's just keep going. But Jesus did. He won't let her just slip away. There are things that need to be said, not least she needs to hear him call her his daughter. Not literal daughter, but daughter figuratively. I love that, don't you? It's the same word that Jairus uses. It's got a slight difference, but the second time Jairus uses it in the passage next week is exactly the same word. Which makes us think, well, does Jairus' concern for his daughter, does that give us an insight into Jesus' heart for the woman? I think it does. Just as Jairus cared for his girl, Jesus, alone really, cared for this woman and all like her. To the world, she was just a nameless, she's not named, faceless entity, a face in the crowd. To Jesus, daughter, you're the apple of my eye. You're my daughter. When others want me to be elsewhere to apparently more urgent needs, I will treat you as a daughter, like Jairus will his daughter. Not just a case to be healed and then gone, but far more than that. I suppose she thought something like, well, I'll not bother Jesus. He won't want to have anything to do with my uncleanness and my little life. I can't possibly share it with him. I'll just slip in and out. He need not even notice that I was there. I'm trying to kind of put this in words to help us this morning. Maybe this helps. She shows a simple confidence, first of all, and faith starts with that simple confidence in Jesus. And then faith discovers that Jesus is not content to lob a cure from a distance, but draw you close. You're not just a face in the crowd to him. I think we can treat Jesus like that. Someone to come to for something, and once we've got that thing, we're okay. We think we're okay. Perhaps with a bit of false humility about not wanting to bother the Lord. I'm sure he's got better things to do. But Jesus did not come to dispense solutions and then disappear. That's what Mary Poppins does. It's not Jesus. There's a two-way relationship to be had. There's a Father's voice to hear. He's not just about getting people healed physically, but seeing people respond to him personally in faith. Makes us look at the woman and think, well, what about me? What about you? How do you treat Jesus? You're staying away in the crowd, or have you allowed that relationship to become a two-way relationship with him? I was thinking maybe we're a bit like this when we're prayerless. Happy to take from him, happy to take his blessings, shy or worse about coming to him. Being in relationship, living that out. But that is why Christ has come. So this is a passage about who Jesus comes for. It's a passage about faith in Christ. We'll build on that next week as we see Jairus and Jesus' words to him, only believe. But it's also set in this scene which encourages us to move on from a childlike trust, to build on that, towards a fuller relationship with the Lord Jesus. Not one from a distance, but a true relationship. To come to the one who values the face in the crowd, brings them out into the open, calling them daughter.